Thanks so much for listening to another podcast episode of Complex Identities. This is your host, Juan Marcos Barjona Gutierrez. In the previous episode, we saw something very interesting that highlighted some significant differences between the Clementine recognitions and the Clementine homilies. Most significantly was the perspective of the recognitions, which adopted a measure of Trinitarian thought. Now, whether this Trinitarian thought actually equated to what we would call Chalcedonian Christianity is a question that we would have to look at some other time. But it's clear that it adopted a perspective that was markedly different from the Clementine homilies, which adopted a stricter, or we might argue a more classical view of monotheism. Now, despite this very interesting and surprising difference, the Jewish background and the continuing Jewish identity of both authors, and I would say that both of the communities that these authors came from, is clear from the text that we have already seen. Now, from their standpoint, the devotion to, or the support, or the embracement of the messianic claims of Jesus were the only distinction between themselves and the rest of the Jewish community that did not believe. And in fact, we see that in the Clementine recognitions itself. Now, the homilies is unequivocal in its view of its unity with the Jewish people. That is to say, the authorship or the community that produced the homilies sees themselves as completely united to the Jewish community. And we find the following statement, which gives us the extent of this idea. And it says, "But we have but one God, one who made creation and arranged the universe, whose Son is the Christ. Obeying Christ, we learn to know what is false from the Scriptures." Now, before we continue with the rest of the quote, we should remember that from the perspective of the homilies, the biblical texts have been corrupted for various reasons, and the oral tradition, something akin to the Torah Shebe'al Peh, is critical to understanding biblical texts correctly. And then Jesus, as the true prophet, is sort of the final arbiter, the final commentator, if you will, that can interpret the biblical text in their ultimate light. Now let's return to the quote. We read, "Moreover, being furnished by our ancestors with the truths of Scriptures, we know that there is only one who made the heavens and the earth, the God of the Jews, and of all who choose to worship him. Our fathers, with a pious thought, setting down a fixed belief in him as the true God, handed down this belief to us." And again, in these last statements, we see several things that are extremely important. The first thing is, we read, being furnished by our ancestors with the truths of the Scriptures. They again believe that there is an oral tradition that has been passed down, and that the interpretation of biblical texts is dependent upon this tradition, and it is something that they have received from their forefathers. The second thing is, I think, probably the most amazing statement, is that they know that there is only one God that has made the heavens and the earth, and this is who? It's the God of the Jews. And I think in this sense, we see in many ways the heart of the Clementine homilies, that their vision is a Jewish one. Now, whether we agree with that or not is irrelevant. It's a question of their perception and how they see the world, the worldview that they have adopted, or the one that they have received, or the one that they have created. For them, there isn't any non-Jewish aspect of this. The only aspect which we can consider to be non-Jewish is the inclusion of non-Jews into this Judaism, if you will, from the standpoint of the community that authored the Clementine homilies. Now, something which is interesting to me is that in many ways it almost reflects a verse in the book of John. Now, the Gospel of John is often considered to be an anti-Jewish work because of its use of the term the Jews. They are no longer simply, the enemies of Jesus are no longer simply the Pharisees or the Sadducees, but it's the Jews. It's a very troubling text in many ways to people who read it within this context, but there's a striking text in the Gospel of John, which to me is very similar to this idea that we just read. It's the encounter between Jesus and the Samaritan woman, where she, of course, talks about the conflict that exists between Jews and Samaritans about, is it appropriate to worship on Mount Gerizim, or should you worship only in Jerusalem? And then Jesus himself makes a statement that salvation is from the Jews, and essentially, if I'm paraphrasing correctly, that Samaritans worship what they do not know. And so it goes back to this legitimization of the revelation that Jews have received, and whatever other issues may exist, salvation is from the Jews. It's an amazing statement, which I think is often lost in the midst of these other passages that are very troubling in many ways, depending on how we read the text. So I think this is critical. And of course, once again, from the perspective of the homilies, there is a unity that exists among Jews. Now, I think it's clear by now that both the Clementine homilies and the recognitions were composed of individuals who observed the Torah and believed that it was important for them, as well as the non-Jews who had joined them, to do so in certain context. Now, the only point of difference, aside from belief in Jesus as the true prophet, was the issue of the temple's destruction. And as I've noted before, for me, it's almost like a moot point. It had been several centuries since the temple had been destroyed. There probably wasn't any realistic opportunity for the reconstruction of the temple after Bar Kokhba. There may have been, Julian, the apostate, the Roman emperor. But for the most part, the expectations of a return to temple worship were probably not realistic at this particular stage. And so I think in many ways, the Clementine literature is addressing this in a way that makes sense to them. Now, of course, the rabbinic sages also contemplated a resolution to the destruction of the temple and the failure to see its rebuilding. Still, they didn't adopt such a radical view as the author of the Clementines, or even that later rabbis would adopt in the medieval period. Now, for the Clementine recognitions and the homilies, their commitment to the Torah is further supported when we look at a statement which we find in the recognitions, which states the following, that God, quote, will please those who have kept and performed the law. So once again, the recognitions, despite its differences in Christology or its adoption of a limited Trinitarian perspective, whatever that might be, it still retains the same views of the Torah, that the Torah is critical to this movement and to the identity of the Jews who have become part of this movement, and as well as to the non-Jews who have joined them. Now, as Karen Zetterhold notes, the scholar that I've mentioned several times in the recent podcast, despite this view, the author's perspective on the practical observance of the Torah concerning non-Jews is somewhat unclear. That is to say, to what extent were the Gentiles actually obligated to observe the commandments, and which commandments were really the critical ones that they should be concerned with? Now, if we stop and we try to relate this to the modern era and our contemporary Jewish observance, we can see some issues with this. And what I mean by that is that most individuals who are nominally religious will observe the Sabbath in some basic form. When you talk about Nida, when you talk about the laws of menstrual purity or of family purity, this is really another level of observance that most individuals in the American Jewish community, at least, do not observe. It's really those Jews who identify as Orthodox or traditional or perhaps conservadox, that term, you know, might be a little bit complicated depending on what that means, who really observe this aspect of the mitzvot, of the commandments. Other people might circumcise their sons. They might light candles on Shabbat. But Nida is a very intensive commandment. It requires a lot from, obviously, a husband and wife, commitment, and the process of going to the mikveh and so forth. And so the stress that the recognitions and the homilies place on Nida is quite interesting, because in many ways it is counterintuitive to what we might expect. And it shows, I think, to some extent, that this is a very different level of observance than we might have expected. In fact, it goes far beyond what we would expect. And I think that's the fascinating aspect of the recognitions and the homilies, is that they combine multiple elements that in many ways defy expectations and assumptions that we make about these communities in a very amazing and exciting time in religious development in late antiquity.